Good evening. It's Saturday, July 4th, 2020. Coming up, protesters gear up to pay Governor Gavin Newsom a visit, calling for the release of San Quentin prisoners as nearly 1,500 test positive for the coronavirus.
It's within his powers, if he chooses right now, to rewrite all the CDCR regulations and order prisoners transferred into hotels at state expense.
Code Pink activists hold caravans and actions calling for independence from war.
We'll obtain real independence and freedom when we finally can abolish war.
As President Trump visits Mount Rushmore, RefuseFascism.org protesters demonstrate across the country calling for the end of the Trump-Pence administration.
Refuse Fascism is calling for nationwide protests on the theme of Trump-Pence must go.
And in the midst of the pandemic, African wildlife refugees are suffering from the loss of tourist revenue that many of them depend on.
We must divorce conservation from tourism.
With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. As coronavirus cases are spiking across the country, the inmates at San Quentin Prison are getting hit particularly hard. Richard Tan is an attorney with the Labor Action Committee to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's been involved with demonstration caravans outside of San Quentin with the slogan, No Death by COVID-19, since May. In May, there were no documented cases at the prison. By mid-June, there were more than 90. And now, there are well over 1,300 cases.
It's really incumbent on Marin County officials to pressure the governor to take dramatic action to release prisoners from San Quentin because it's a public health issue.
Tan says that many prisoners are refusing the test.
So if you get a positive COVID test, you'll be taken out of your cell. Prisoners, in order not to be transferred out of their cells, are refusing to be tested. So the actual number of cases is likely much higher.
Aaron Wallace is the fiancé of Larry Williams, who is among the San Quentin inmates that tested positive.
Test came back positive on the 11th, but they didn't tell him or move him until the 15th. So he could have been, you know, passing it to other people for those 4 days, because he didn't know that he was positive. And then they transferred him to the adjustment center. It's in a single cell. They only give him one thing of clean sheets, so he cleans his own sheets. He hasn't gotten any new clean sheets since the 15th of June. They don't really give him sanitizer.
So are you saying he's in his cell, basically, he's in his cell on his own and he's not coming out of the cell at all? Is that how they're handling this?
Yeah, so they're not getting anything. They don't come out. The only time they come out is for, like, get their temp checks and stuff like that. Most of the time they do it through the food slots. So he has bad knees, so he has to bend down on the ground. And so now he's going to start refusing to even do that. He's like, I want to be, you know, given the test correctly.
Wallace says her fiance believes he got the virus while working at the prison.
The day before they tested him, he was asked with five other inmates to move all the property from the transferred inmates from Chino. He was asked to move all their property. So they moved probably hundreds of boxes and supplies of all their stuff. So he thinks that's how he got it, was moving all their belongings to the fifth and the fourth tiers. They were sweating, their pores were open. And that immediately that night, he started feeling like having sweats and his appetite started going. So that night he called me. He's like, I think I got COVID.
Wallace says her fiance hasn't received medical care outside of temperature checks and being advised to stop his blood pressure medicine during the virus, but hasn't been told when or if he can resume it.
He's retaining the water in his knees, so he should be taking water pills, but he doesn't know to go back on it because of COVID and all that.
Wallace says she hopes Governor Newsom will look at the prisoners on a case-by-case basis so that nonviolent offenders like her fiance could be held on house arrest. Richard Tan says he has even higher hopes and expectations for Governor Newsom.
During a state of emergency, and there's a coronavirus state of emergency right now, Governor Newsom has very wide-ranging emergency powers. And back when the coronavirus started, he actually explicitly invoked his power to commandeer private property, which includes hotels and medical facilities to deal with the coronavirus. So it's within his powers, if he chooses right now, to rewrite all the CDCR regulations and order prisoners transferred into hotels at state expense, and then we wouldn't have the situation that we have right now.
Tan is asking demonstrators and listeners who'd like to join Sunday's protest to gather at Northridge Plaza Shopping Center at 4840 San Juan Avenue in Fair Oaks, California at noon. At 12:30, demonstrators will proceed to Governor Newsom's home, where they will call on the governor to take immediate action at San Quentin.
Code Pink Women for Peace today held banner drops in the Bay Area under the theme Independence from War. One on the I-80 pedestrian bridge near University Avenue in Berkeley, and the other at the Highland Avenue Bridge over the San Jose exit to I-280 in San Francisco. Their banners included messages saying, defund the police, defund the Pentagon, demilitarize, healthcare, not warfare, and make America love again. KPFA spoke with Code Pink activists Toby Blomé and Eleanor Levine earlier this week. They talked about today's actions and the need to stop war.
The national organization Code Pink has invited chapters to do actions all across the country on 4th of July with the underlying theme of demanding independence from war. And so some groups are having car caravans, and locally our chapters have decided to do multiple bannerings to get messages in as many places as we can against war and get people on 4th of July to really recognize what is underlying the messages of 4th of July and hopefully get them to think about the importance of peace, and we'll obtain real independence and freedom when we finally can abolish war and the militarism that's part of our U.S. foreign policy.
Of course, the 4th of July declaring independence, which involved a war against the British. So a country founded in war, which is not uncommon. How would you respond to people who say, well, you can't avoid it? These conflicts break out and you have to defend the country.
Well, that would be a really long conversation, but I'm a big fan of Howard Zinn, and he really was very successful at debunking the idea that we needed the American Revolution, for example, to have an independent country, and all the other wars that are really considered the good wars, World War II and the Civil War, for example. And so often, you know, we hear that rationalization that war is necessary, but I think that we need to start thinking, because we're destroying the planet that we're living in with this horrible state of global warfare right now that's doing harm on so many different levels. And I'm sure Eleanor has some good things to contribute to that.
Well, I would just say that when you have an historical pattern of violence, it is the first recourse you come to or you think about when you're trying to solve a problem. And negotiated peaces and negotiated settlements that are just and fair take a long time to work out. But the long-term results are much more satisfying and much more sustaining for the earth and for people and just historically than solutions that come through violence.
That's Code Pink activist Toby Blomé and Eleanor Levine.
This Independence Day arrives with less than the usual lively and carefree attitudes that many people were once accustomed to. In the midst of a resurgence of new coronavirus cases, cities and states across the country are grappling with another round of potential lockdowns to keep the virus at bay. This month also ushers in the 27th annual San Francisco Labor Fest, a month-long celebration for working people, highlighting the challenges that workers face. KPFA's Lola Kamu reports.
The 4th of July holiday is a welcome distraction from the grim reality of the COVID-19 pandemic. City and state officials are warning residents to stay indoors and find alternate ways to celebrate. But many families and workers are not in a celebratory mood due to a host of challenges laid bare by the pandemic. This week, the Labor Department's report on the economy was mediocre at best, and economists say recovery is still a long ways off. The theme for this year's Labor Fest is entitled Labor, Resist, Revolt, Building a New Future. The month-long event will be held on Zoom and is free to the public. The lineup of topics range from labor unions and the police to the gig economy and the AB5 bill and the struggle of the working class. Steven Zeltzer is an organizer with Labor Fest. He says the working class is under attack and that the pandemic has exposed a lot of issues that highlight the need for radical change.
Well, working people have been under attack for a long time, you know, decades and decades. The history of workers in this country is they've been under attack. The right to form a union, although it's supposed to be legal, thousands of workers have been fired who try to form unions. But what the pandemic has done is expose the real contradictions in our society, because the most vulnerable workers, black and brown workers, frontline workers, food workers, Tesla workers, and others are very vulnerable, and they've been forced to go out back to work in many cases without any PPE protection, and also vulnerable to get COVID without any health care in some cases. So the mass layoffs as a result of the depression we're in now has meant that 27 million people in the United States have no health care. So this pandemic has actually exposed the contradictions in our society and the need to really have a radical transformation.
Zeltzer says unions play a key role in the labor movement because they give workers more power.
Unions should be in the forefront of fighting to protect workers' health and safety. An example is in Korea, the Healthcare Workers Union, Public Services and Transportation Public Workers Union in Korea actually organized to go to every work site and demand that the employers provide proper PPE at hospitals and had rallies and that kind of thing. As a result of that, not one healthcare worker in Korea has died. So unions need to be proactive. I know that the nurses here have been having regular rallies to demand proper PPE for healthcare workers. And I think unions in every area, Teamsters, SEIU, all unions need to be in the forefront because workers individually have a problem speaking out for fear of retaliation. And this is exactly the case at Tesla, where there are 10 to 15,000 workers, and many of those workers, black, brown, immigrant, and they don't have a union. Elon Musk, the billionaire owner, has prevented unionization. So the necessity of a union is critical.
Again, that was Steven Zeltzer, organizer with LaborFest. To learn more and to see the full schedule of events, visit the LaborFest website at laborfest.net. I'm Lola Komu, reporting for KPFA News.
Auto Workers Union said today that workers at Bajaj Auto, India's biggest exporter of motorbikes, are demanding the temporary closure of one of its plants after 250 employees there tested positive for coronavirus. India went into complete lockdown in late March to curb the spread of the virus, but the government has recently eased restrictions despite an increasing number of cases. The Bajaj Auto factory affected is located in the state with the highest number of cases of COVID-19. The company said in a letter to employees this week that those who do not show up for work will not be paid. The company said in late June that 140 of the roughly 8,000 staff at the factory had caught the virus and two had died.
On the eve of Independence Day, President Donald Trump, speaking at Mount Rushmore in South Dakota, accused protesters who have pushed for racial justice of engaging in a merciless campaign to wipe out U.S. history. The president zeroed in on the desecration by some demonstrators of monuments and statues across the country that honor those who have benefited from slavery, including some past presidents. His comments appear to be a direct appeal to his political base. The speech and fireworks at Mount Rushmore came across a backdrop of pandemic that has killed over 125,000 Americans. Most of the people who came to see Trump were maskless, and all of them were flaunting public health guidelines that recommended not gathering in large groups. This week in RefuseFascism.org is calling for nationwide protests, saying that it is time for the Trump-Pence administration to go. Barry Thornton is the spokesperson for Refuse Fascism in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Trump is going to Mount Rushmore, I mean, all of which is an expression of his fascist agenda, which is support of genocide, support of slavery. He's defending Confederate monuments. He's threatening people with years in prison for attacking Confederate monuments. This is all part of a larger fascist agenda, stripping rights from women, transforming the whole character of the government into extreme repression. And so all of this is sort of unfolding. And we have a very powerful and beautiful movement opposing police murder and white supremacy. All this is coming to a head as the coronavirus soars. So very, very tense moment. Refuse Fascism is calling for nationwide protests on the theme of Trump-Pence must go.
Thornton says that RefuseFascism.org is asking that all protesters wear masks and practice social distancing while also using their voices to take a stand. You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, and K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota.
There is a brewing geopolitical rivalry in the Arctic that has some observers worried. As some Washington policymakers have pointed out, Russia does have more icebreakers in the region than the United States, and they're saying that the U.S. needs to catch up to the Russians as quickly as possible. But critics of U.S. policy say that what some call the icebreaker gap is a poor excuse to accelerate the militarization of a region that is possibly facing an environmental catastrophe. Robert English is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. We asked him if, in addition to the usual excuses for more military spending, some of the expressed concern about perceived enemies has more to do with reward-seeking government bureaucrats wanting to show what a good job they're doing.
What you just described happens between the services, as well as the services jointly against the butter side of the budget. They are the gun side, right? So sometimes they cooperate, sometimes they are rivals, but it's always a machine pushing for more, pushing to inflate the threat, justify more. Some of it is just promotion. You know, we could spend a whole hour talking about how this has worked in the past, but if your program gains in prominence, right, your department might justify some promotion. You are a one-star general, wouldn't you like a second star? Well, when your budget doubles and your staff is increased, then it'll be necessary to promote the leadership and you might get that promotion. So personal, budgetary, status, all of these drive this endless appetite.
What about the Russians? What are they actually doing in the Arctic?
So yes, let's get back to reality. And part of the complication here is with a simple glance at what's happening in the Arctic, the Russians have been building up their security infrastructure there. And from where they were 10 or 15 years ago, they have acquired significant new ships, some bases, some new air power, but mostly things designed for defense, right? So that means coastal defense ships. That means missile batteries that aren't much good for attacking, but if you encroach on their airspace, watch out. And the same across the board. Most of what they have built up has a defensive character, although it's not always easy to distinguish. That's the first thing. But the second thing that's almost always missing in these threat assessments, in these icebreaker gap arguments, is that Russia was starting from such a low point 20 years ago because everything collapsed after the Cold War. And for a decade, their military infrastructure shrank. And in the Arctic, they pretty much disappeared. The Soviets, the Russians, had a huge Arctic research. There's scientific work up there. There's economic, of course. There's petroleum, minerals. There's simply a huge indigenous population, right? Half of all the world's population, indigenous people that live in the Arctic, are Russians, because they live in Russia. So all of that meant Russia was always an Arctic power, had a big Arctic presence, and much of that vanished in the 90s when everything collapsed. So yes, they're building up, but they're building up from such a low point that it still in no way rivals what the US and NATO bring to the table.
That's University of Southern California Professor Robert English.
Authorities said early today that two women were struck by a car whose driver sped through a protest-related closure on a freeway in Seattle. Washington State Patrol Captain Ron Mead said a 24-year-old woman from Seattle suffered critical life-threatening injuries and a 32-year-old woman from Bellingham had serious injuries. Mead said the driver, a 27-year-old man from Seattle, was in custody. Charges remain under investigation, as does the motive and point of entry into the interstate. Seattle has been the site of prolonged protests following the May 25th police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis.
It used to be the case that the left was considered the main opposition to imperialism, but after the Cold War ended, many liberals became enamored with the concept of humanitarian intervention. Some progressives were critical of that tendency. Nation magazine contributor James Carden recently wrote an article for Counterpunch on the return of what he calls the anti-war left. We asked him if he believed that the left, or at least the soft liberal left, has collapsed as an anti-war voice.
That's true. What prompted the thought was reading Diane Johnstone's recent memoir, and she recounts an episode that I personally am not too familiar with. I wasn't particularly politically involved in the late 90s, but the situation surrounding U.S. involvement in Balkans, in particular, the decision by the Clinton administration to launch a war against Serbia over Kosovo, it struck me that there were some very interesting and troubling parallels between the left's response then and the left's response today with regard to Russiagate and with regard to the war in Syria. And it seemed like anyone like Johnson back then, who voiced reasonable objections to the program, were demonized and were kept, you know, largely kept out of the discourse. So, and I personally have noticed that with regard to the way that liberals have sort of coalesced around both Russiagate and Syria.
Aren't anti-war voices generally marginalized anyway in the media? I mean, regardless of the war, if you look at who the commentators are in the broadcast media, who's quoted in the print media, it's mostly people who are in the center or the center right. You don't hear too many anti-war voices anyway, do you?
No, of course not. But the troubling thing is that you would think at least they would have a home on the left end of the spectrum. They don't. And I think part of the reason is a lot of it has to do with Trump. A lot of it has to do with Russiagate. The moment that Donald Trump won, liberals basically threw their lot in with Never Trump neoconservatives. And that's one of the more troubling developments of the past several years. This was something that I warned about in The Nation in 2015, because you could see that a lot of neocons like Robert Kagan and Bill Kristol were definitely not on board with Trumpian style conservatism. And they began to quite publicly line up behind Hillary Clinton. And I knew that that was going to spell trouble for people like myself who are Democrats, but who are anti-interventionists. And the reason I thought that is because if you know anything about the history of the neoconservative movement in this country, they were originally Democrats. So they were basically going to migrate back to their party of origin.
That's Nation magazine contributor James Carden.
African wildlife refugees are suffering from the loss of tourist revenue that most of them depend on. KPFA's Ann Garrison has the story.
Critics of the prevailing conservation model in Africa decry its dependence on revenue from safari tourism. Kenyan ecologist Mordecai Ogata, co-author of The Big Conservation Lie, has said over and over that tourism should never motivate conservation.
Tourism should always be a byproduct of conservation. It should never be the purpose or reason for conservation. If there's anything like a silver bullet for sorting out the problem we have now, it's understanding of that simple statement. But so far, it's still been very difficult for the policymakers and sector leaders in Kenya to understand that simple statement.
Coronavirus has, Ogata says, revealed the fallacy of neocolonial thinking about conservation. He believes that the Kenyan government should pay for it, just as they pay for other matters of state.
This one has shut down everything, and it has revealed the fallacy of thinking that tourism, safari tourism, can underpin conservation. Our government should take it up as a governmental duty, just the way our government fully funds the Kenya police, the prisons, the military administration, and all these other sectors. Kenya Wildlife Service should not in any way be dependent on tourism earnings in order to perform their constitutional mandate.
Ogata says that the safari tourism model was established by Teddy Roosevelt's trip to Kenya in 1909, during which he and his entourage trekked across the savannah on horseback with black porters walking alongside and collected hundreds of animals for the Smithsonian Zoo.
The father of the tourism thinking as it is now, I think, is Teddy Roosevelt with his famous safari to Kenya in 1909. That romanticized it. The long lines of porters trekking across on foot with white people on horses hunting. And that's Roosevelt and his party, the famous photos of it. It's still celebrated in a big way in the U.S. And this is what cemented that power structure.
Ogata said that if he were in power in Kenya, he would create separate ministries of conservation and tourism.
We must divorce conservation from tourism. If I had the power, I'd put them under separate cabinet ministries and separate cabinet ministers so that one takes care of the heritage for our sake. The other now markets what we have taken care of.
Biological diversity, Ogata said, must include human diversity.
And one of the most fascinating things about Kenya that is not available in any other country in the world is the Kenyan people. Any tourism that's packaged not to include local people is passé. That's completely useless. You often see that tourists and tour operators complaining that they went to Samburu or Masai Mara and they saw too many livestock and people around there. If you don't want to see Samburu people, don't come to Kenya. If you don't want to see Maasai people, don't come to Kenya. Nobody ever goes to China and complains that there were too many Chinese people, or Indian complains that there are too many Indian people. So we must include our local people as active intellectual participants in this.
In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
Some progressive activists are criticizing the Berkeley Police Department for the way it deals with people with mental health issues. They say officers often end up confronting individuals with mental challenges without the help of mental health workers who are better equipped to handle those situations. Andrea Pritchett is a founding member of Berkeley Cop Watch and serves on the Berkeley Mental Health Commission. We asked her about the city of Berkeley's policy on having mental health professionals accompany police when they are called on to deal with mentally challenged people.
Unfortunately, our mental health services in Berkeley have essentially, since the shelter in place, suspended mobile crisis services, which sometimes accompany the police and generally don't make a large difference in how those situations play out. The mobile crisis unit doesn't direct the situation, doesn't direct the scene. If the officers say that it's okay, the mobile crisis workers can go in there and interview and evaluate the person. But it's the police who are firmly in control of this. The reason why this is a problem is not only because the police re-traumatize the individual, they make the situation worse for that person.
Do all the officers act the same way? Do they just sort of follow a standard procedure? Or will some of them kind of hold back and not handcuff the people and not use physical force?
I think what happens is this is where it really becomes clear what kind of training people have. Police officers generally, you know, it's sort of like that George Floyd thing. When they're going to handcuff somebody, they're going to use 3, 4, 5 people to do it. You know, and that's, I think that's an officer safety protocol. Overwhelming force on the individual, so none of the officers are jeopardized. They're not trained in real de-escalation. They're not trained to use their voice, to use their body, to provide people with options, to use time in order to allow somebody to calm down. Give somebody a glass of water. Listen to them. Take the time to let their limbic system, to let them calm down. So the officers are like, yep, we got to do this fast. We're going to do this quick. We're going to wrap them up and get them out of here. The city council just approved its annual budget. People were calling for a 50% reduction in the police budget. Now, some people say that's outrageous. And yet, if you look at it, over 90% of police expenses are personnel. It's a website called Transparent California. You can see how much our police officers are paid. We have about 6 or 7 officers who are making upwards of $400,000 a year in total compensation.
That's Andrea Pritchett of Berkeley Cop Watch.
And the weather. In the San Francisco Bay Area, lows in the 50s tonight, sunny tomorrow with highs approaching 90. In the central San Joaquin Valley, lows in the upper 60s tonight with highs nearing 100 for tomorrow. That's it for this evening's newscast. Thanks to Ann Garrison and Lola Akamu for helping to prepare this news, and to Carla West, our technical producer. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.